Happy Earth Day, everyone, and this is Mark Steiner, your host for Soundbites and The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. In the second half of our show, we're going to conclude our conversation with former Maryland State Senator Gerald Weingrad, who was known as the environmental conscience of the Maryland State Senate when he served there. We'll continue our conversation from last week about the state of the Bay and what happened with agriculture and the environment in the just-concluded state legislative session. We're also going to talk with Will Allen, the former professional basketball player and MacArthur Genius Award winner and urban farmer. But first, we're about to talk once again with Mark Hertzgard. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation, writes for many journals, Daily Beast, The Nation, and most recently the author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, which we've talked to him about before. And Mark, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Always good to be with you.
So I was really interested in the piece you wrote on Cove Point. Let me start there, and what you call the other keystone. We've been covering the development of this liquid natural gas facility in St. Mary's County in Maryland at Cove Point, which many people in the community are standing up against. Mike Tidwell, the leaders of climate against around issues of climate change, helping to lead that protest along with a number of local people in the community. But this liquid natural gas thing is so much bigger than Cove Point, because America's becoming the kind of the Saudi Arabia of gas in many ways. That's what makes this whole issue not just a local issue, but much more complex and involved than that.
Yes, I think Cove Point, understandably, is a huge issue for Maryland and Virginia. But the reason we wrote about it in The Nation magazine is that it's also a national and an international issue. These kinds of facilities that are proposed at Cove Point down there on the Chesapeake Bay south of D.C., these kinds of facilities are called liquid natural gas facilities, and they are essential to the idea of taking natural gas from the United States and exporting it abroad. And that's for the simple reason that, natural gas in general, because of its physical nature, it travels by pipeline. So the huge supplies of natural gas that lay beneath the United States in general can only be sent to other customers in North America. Whereas if you want to reach export markets, you have to change that natural gas into a liquid form, change the gas into liquid, and then put the liquid onto big ships that can take it across the ocean. That's why there is this idea of building the liquid natural gas facility at Cove Point. And it's also why the Obama administration and many Republicans in Congress, and of course the fossil fuel industry itself, are saying that liquid natural gas and Cove Point in particular could be very useful to U.S. foreign policy against Russia, in particular during the Ukraine crisis here, because, of course, Russia supplies most of the, I shouldn't say most, but about 40% of the natural gas that is used in Western Europe, and much of that gas flows through the Ukraine. So the idea is that if the U.S. could export its own natural gas, that would reduce the amount of leverage that Russia has on Europe.
You know, this is a really important point. You raised it in your article, and Naomi Klein wrote a piece about this as well, that you know, when you have this whole question of Ukraine really does fit into this, and that's why I'm saying this is so complex and has so many parts to it that are beyond just what people are considering a local protest. I mean, as you point out in your article, there's an editorial in the New York Times around Ukraine that talks about the United States Energy Department approved permits for only 6 of 21 liquid natural gas facilities, and they have to, and the quote you have is, they have to speed up its review of export applications, the U.S. Department of Energy they're calling on. And so, I mean, this is what, A, makes these battles so difficult, because you're talking about a billion-dollar oil and gas industry, pushing foreign policy, parts of foreign policy, and this need of this industry to grow. So that's why this is such a huge and complex issue.
It is very complex. It's a matter of foreign policy and national security policy, but and very big economic interests, of course. But I would point out that you can flip that around And the fact is that, you know, they can't push that natural gas out of the country unless the local people in Maryland and Virginia allow that Cove Point facility to be built. And as I pointed out in my piece in The Nation, you know, we covered the demonstration that took place there in Baltimore in February.
Right.
There's been a lot of demonstrations and arrests since then. And one of the things that we know from 40 years of the last 40 years of environmental activism in this country is that a lot of the environmental battles are won at the local level, where citizens, ordinary people, still do have political agency. It's not just a question of, oh, some, you know, congressional committee in Washington or some regulatory agency in the federal bureaucracy is going to decide this. No, citizens can actually go and protest and write to their representatives. They can blockade. They can commit civil disobedience. And those things, those obstacles are not easy for big oil companies or government agencies to overcome.
I mean, that when I was thinking about this in terms of, you ended one of the articles wondering what John Kerry would do, Secretary of State John Kerry might do, and as Heather Mazzeo, who's running for governor here in Maryland, has said, and others have said, that as a senator, as an individual, he has this powerful environmental record, but what is he up against inside the administration with all the other influences, both in terms of the Keystone Pipeline and in terms of these LNGs, even though they talked about the UN report coming out saying the International Panel on Climate Change's report saying we have to stop taking anything out of the earth. But that's what I'm talking about, these contradictions and how we help people and help ourselves put our hands around this to understand it.
I think Secretary of State Kerry's role here is fascinating, and so I was very interested to interview Heather Mazzeo, the candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor there in Maryland in this November's election, because Ms. Mazur used to work for John Kerry.
Right.
She was a top aide to John Kerry when he was a senator. And so I kind of put her on the spot, and I said, you know, have you talked with him about this? And she says, I've tried to, and I plan to, but, you know, he's been busy with Syria and this and that and the other. And that's when I said, well, which way do you think he'll go on this? I find it, you know, personally, it will be very hard for Secretary of State Kerry to say yes to Keystone. You know, that's right in his bailiwick. The Cove Point, it's not clear what role he, as Secretary of State, would have there, if any. But the Keystone XL pipeline, which would cross the border between Canada and the United States, therefore becomes an issue for the Secretary of State. John Kerry has built his professional politician's career on protection of the environment. You'd be hard-pressed to find another issue that he has been more outspoken on. So how he then could turn around and green light the Keystone XL pipeline, that's not going to be easy for him. And, of course, the environmental movement is trying to push and push and push and make that clear to him that, you know, you can't really have it both ways. The climate leaders don't support Keystone. Climate leaders don't support fracking. That's what, you know, we're hearing in Cove Point. And, of course, in California, where I live now, this is also becoming an issue with Governor Jerry Brown, who's considering fracking in California for oil, not gas, but same idea. And he is getting bird-dogged at all of his public events now by activists saying, climate leaders don't frack, Governor Brown. So, you know, it's the same old story. We've got the power of the people on the ground, which is basically bodies and numbers, versus the power of money and the status quo. And we'll see who wins.
Well, we all will see who wins, but one of the things you write about, many people have written about, but you write about so well in this, in all this, has been what natural gas does, what happens when methane is released. I mean, because the problem is there's this battle over facts, right? I mean, you have the folks who want to build this new LNG facility in Cove Point saying this will reduce energy emissions by 43% or whatever that number was. And then others are arguing about the reality of emissions that are created in creating liquid natural gas and getting it to the point where it can actually be used for coal not to be used. I mean, people are very confused by this on one level.
Yeah, it's a scientific dispute. I would point out that the claims that that fracking gas and that liquid natural gas will be a positive from a climate perspective, that comes from a consultant to the oil industry. So not terribly surprising that they would say that. And we've seen many issues in the past in the general environmental field that are highly complex scientifically, you know, nuclear power, for example. And that has not prevented ordinary people from inserting themselves into those battles. You know, it's not, because there are some scientists who play it straight and who will tell you, okay, you know, here's what the oil industry scientist is telling you, or the Bureau of Land Management scientist is telling you, but here's what regular science tells us. So I understand that it's complicated, but I think that there's been, and this has been one of the great contributions, I think, of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, Mike Tidwell and his folks, is to really break down that science in a way that is comprehensible to average people.
So, I mean, can you, I mean, let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, what are the real issues here in terms of what, of what is it at risk here? I mean, when you and others and the panel on climate change said that we have to leave 2/3 of the Earth's remaining fossil fuel underground. If we don't, then limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels will not happen. That's you know, people hear that and they go, "Well, what does that mean?" I mean, my car runs on gas. My house is heated by oil, electricity, which is fueled by coal and oil, my husband has a job at gas and electric or building this new plant. You know what I mean? I mean, it's...
Sure. Well, it means that we've got to shift off of the old infrastructure of energy and onto the new one. And, you know, it's not just people like Mark Hertzgaard or activists who are saying this. Shell Oil, Royal Dutch Shell, which is the world's second largest oil company, has just endorsed the very same point that you made, Mark, that essentially 2/3 of the remaining fossil fuel reserves on Earth have to stay underground, undisturbed, and they have to do that in order to prevent dangerous amounts of climate change. So even Shell Oil now is acknowledging this, and therefore acknowledging that we do have to shift. We have to shift onto different energy sources, just like in the past we shifted from using wood to coal because coal was better. And we shifted eventually from coal to oil. Now the next shift is going to be from coal and oil onto solar and wind. And by the way, there is an awful lot happening in solar and wind in particular. Solar power is now being adopted worldwide faster than cell phones were. It's just an extraordinary explosion of the solar market, especially on rooftops. And so it's not like we can't do this. It will be a huge transition. There's no question about it. But it's eminently doable from a technical standpoint. And, you know, the science makes it pretty clear we don't have any choice. And so it's very interesting that Shell Oil is now coming around to admit this as well. And I think that will change a lot of people's ideas about this once that knowledge permeates through the business press and the political circles and so forth.
So when did that happen with Shell Oil, and what do you think that means in terms of their drilling and looking for new resources?
Yeah, that happened with Shell Oil about 2 weeks ago. It got very little attention in the mainstream media.
I mean, even I missed it, and I try to follow these things.
Yeah. Well, Bloomberg News, which is not exactly a small news outfit, they ran a story about this. So it's not like it's been ignored, and if you're following the business press, it's there. But you know, the cynic would point out that, well, Shell hopes to have a growing business in what is called carbon capture and storage. So that means that you take the carbon dioxide that, say, a power plant emits just through the burning of coal or other fossil fuels, you capture it and you store it back underground or someplace where it cannot heat up the atmosphere. So, you know, Shell hopes to make money doing that. Well, so what? You know, that's the nature of the beast. And as I say, we've got to transition away from these old forms of energy. And I think Shell is being a very smart, forward-looking energy company and realizing that, you know, we can't continue with the old ways. And the world is changing quickly around us. Let's change with it. Let's get out ahead of this shift. And if we're the first ones into this business, we'll be the ones who make the money.
So that's really very interesting. I mean, there's, you know, and I was thinking when you said solar panels on roofs, I immediately thought about the things that some people in the city that I'm broadcasting from, which is also your hometown, Baltimore. Well, at least where you grew up, anyway.
Yeah.
That Clark Peters, who was an actor on The Wire, had this proposal in the Charles Village community where he owns a home, saying that what should happen is there should be tax reductions or something for people to put solar panels on their roofs, their flat roofs, all across Charles Village, so we can begin to become energy independent and heat our own homes and the community's needs. I mean, those are the kind of things that cities and localities have to think about doing to begin this shift.
Well, and a lot of cities are. I just saw a report this morning on 20 cities across the United States that are doing this. Los Angeles, you know, you could hardly find a bigger symbol of the 20th century's pollution excesses than Los Angeles. But Los Angeles is now the leading city in the United States on solar power. And it's growing very fast in a lot of states and localities across the nation. I just heard a story on national NPR the other day, too, about an entrepreneur in Pakistan who is planning to build a solar-powered car. Now, this car would only travel 50 miles, so for many Americans that wouldn't be acceptable. But for Pakistanis, that is more than adequate. He wants to make this car for $2,000, $3,000, and he says, this will solve many problems for our country. So, you know, as soon as you change the government policies and the mindsets behind those policies, the things that say, oh, we can't possibly shift away from oil. We use it to run our cars. We can't possibly shift away from gas. We use it to you know, heat our homes and cook our food and so forth. As soon as you change that and say, well, no, we are going to shift, you know, the marketplace and private enterprise and entrepreneurial innovation can take you a long way. We're seeing this now also in Germany, you know, the world's leading export nation. Germany is now getting off of not only fossil fuels, but also nuclear power, and they are shifting to solar and wind, geothermal, energy efficiency. And again, why are they doing this? They're doing this because they believe, and I say this about all the government parties, the business elite, the labor leaders, etc., they've made a kind of a uniform determination that this is going to be our strategy in Germany, because we believe that in the 21st century, the new energy foundation for the global economy is going to be renewable. It's going to be solar, wind, and the others. And we want Germany to dominate that market, so we're going to get there first. I wish there was more thinking like that inside of the United States.
So let me ask you two other questions here. One, just quickly on what you said, and the other about how this might happen. As you've written, and others have written, but as you've written, most polls show that the concern about the future of energy and climate change is at the bottom of most people's agenda in America, and that in some ways has to shift.
Yeah, I think, you know, those polls always find that what matters most to people, not surprising, is their immediate economic situation. And, of course, with polling, you always have to look at when the poll was taken and what the questions were. You know, you get a different answer if you talk to people right after Hurricane Sandy. How do you feel about extreme weather?
Right.
You would get a different answer also if our news media did a better job of connecting the dots between extreme weather and climate change, which they are beginning to do. And you also get a different answer depending on which demographics you talk to. Here's the most fascinating poll finding I've come across recently, which is that 53% of Republicans under the age of 35 regard the denial of climate science, which is basically what their party practices in Washington, at least their political leaders in Washington practice denial of climate science. Most young Republicans regard that as, quote, ignorant, out of touch, or crazy, unquote. Those are Republicans. So if you talk to younger people, you know, most of them are quite clear about what climate change means. It's a big, big issue for them. And that, again, is going to have effects, I think, on politics, because the Republican Party is beginning to realize, at least some of the saner heads in the Republican Party are realizing, you know, we cannot win national elections if we continue to stick our head in the sand on climate change, on gay rights, and on immigration, because younger people, whether we like it or not, do not agree with the hard right orthodoxy that now governs the Republican Party on those issues.
There was something, this goes to the heart of something else that you wrote about, and I want to try to put these two things together. One of the things you wrote about that you've said, and many people have said, is that roughly two-thirds of the Earth's resources have to be left in the ground. You also wrote this piece in your article, The Other Keystone, about what's happening in Minnesota with a bill where they want to have 40% of all the state's electricity coming from renewable resources by 2030, and your argument being that this could be a rallying cry in progressive states across country, Maryland included, where that should be what we're pushing for. And many people argue that it could take 30 years to change our entire energy system from relying on fossil fuels to renewables, but it could be done, and this particular thing gets us halfway there. So talk a bit about that and where that is in America right now.
Yeah, the renewable portfolio standards is a way of government regulations encouraging the shift to solar and wind. And let's remember that, this is not special favors for renewables. This is evening the playing field after many, many decades and hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax dollars that Washington has directed to favor oil and gas and nuclear power. So these kinds of shifts in subsidies will help a lot. They're already helping enormously, and they could do a lot more if they were expanded. And I think that's why Mike Tidwell of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network is saying we should have a national campaign called 40% or Bust, because if we can get renewables up to 40% of the electrical mix, that would call for so much additional investment in supply and manufacturing that we would lower the costs for solar to where they would take over the rest of the market, because you'd get economies of scale, the producers would climb the learning curve, and just like with computers, that the more you make them, the better you get at making them, and the costs go down, and therefore more and more consumers buy them. I think if you did that, you'd see an enormous, even a larger explosion of solar and wind and other green energy sources than we've seen to date.
So talk a bit about because this kind of wraps into a place that you raise in your most recent book, that I think, it was an anathema to most people in the environmental movement, which is the notion of adaptation, because people thought it was a distraction.
Yeah.
And your argument is that you, I think your quote is, avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. And how that fits into what you were just talking about and what you mean by adaptation and why you don't think it is throwing up the white flag.
No, it's not. Adaptation is the scientist's term for basically coping with the impacts of climate change. And unfortunately, because we've not listened enough to science these last 25 years, and we have continued to emit heat-trapping greenhouse gases, we are now locked in to a substantial amount of climate change on this planet because climate change is cumulative, and the carbon dioxide stays up in the atmosphere for decades and decades. So right now, my 9-year-old daughter and the rest of her generation are already locked in to living most of their rest of their lifetimes on the hottest planet that our civilization has ever faced. So we're going to see record heat waves. We're going to see, you remember 2012, summer of 2012, which was the hottest summer in recorded history in the United States, the worst drought in 50 years. Well, by the time my daughter Kiara is my age, in the middle of the century, that's going to be the new normal. We're going to have to live with that level of heat, drought, floods, etc., all of these impacts. So adapting to those is no longer an option, much less a distraction. It's an imperative. We have got to figure out how to live with those things. And we have to do it not just for self-interest, but I would say for reasons of morality, because the people who are going to be hit first and worst, who already are being hit first and worst by this, are the global poor. I'm thinking of people in places like southern Bangladesh, where I traveled to report for my book, Hot, where it's so low-lying that even just 7 inches of sea level rise that they experienced during the 20th century is already putting rice lands underwater and, you know, making them salty because the salt water, ocean water, is getting up in there and lowering yields. And so, you know, we have, I think, a duty of human solidarity to help the poor who did nothing to cause this problem. You know, they're not driving the cars, flying the airplanes, running the power plants, et cetera, that have spewed all these heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere. It was our civilization in Europe, and in the United States, and now increasingly in China and India, but our civilization that did that, and we got rich and comfortable doing so. So we need to do what's right and help them to adapt. But at the same time, equally important, we have got to turn down the temperature over the long term. We've got to get off of fossil fuels. We've got to leave most of the fossil fuels in the ground. Otherwise, the temperature rise is going to be so high and the impacts of it are going to be so massive that no amount of adaptation is going to save us.
Well, I'm going to encourage everybody to read the articles we're going to post online. This latest piece, Can Generation Avoid, Generation Hot Avoid Its Fate, from the Daily Beast, will put onto our website, as well as the other keystone that appeared in The Nation, along with the other Nation piece. If we want to adapt to climate change, we need to start now. There's three pieces for you all to wrestle with, as we've been talking here with my friend and an important thinker and activist in our world, Mark Hertzgaard. His most recent book, Hot: Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, we'll attach that as well on our website. Mark, thank you so much for this time.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Mark. Thanks for doing this.
We have to take a very quick break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll be talking with Gerald Weingrad about the state of the Bay and what our politicians did and did not do to help her in this last session. Happy Earth Day, everyone, and this is Mark Steiner, your host for Soundbites and The Mark Steiner Show, here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And I'm talking with former State Senator Jerry Weingrad, who's an attorney, and when he was in the State Senate, was known as the environmental conscience of the Senate. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Policy, where he's been teaching a graduate course on Chesapeake Bay restoration since 1988. I know this is not the most uplifting in terms of what's accomplished, but I hope that it gets people inspired enough to think about what it is we need to do. The Chesapeake Bay Agreement, that also seems to have, is like disintegrating in front of our eyes. I mean, you can describe it.
Well, the first Chesapeake Bay Agreement is what began the whole Bay cleanup. I was there. It was in December, on December 9th, 1983. And as we were talking, we're both getting to be, we met each other in 1982.
Too, right.
Getting to be very old men. Unfortunately, the hands of time only move forward. And when I was there, the Bay Agreement was a half page long. Governor Hughes was a leader. We knew what we were going to do with all the Bay initiatives, like the critical area law. And the other governors were there, U.S. senators, Jacques Cousteau is incredible, 700 people there with the enthusiasm, let's roll our sleeves up and get this done. So it created the Bay program. And believe it or not, the first funding for the Bay program to set up the EPA Bay program office in Annapolis was $10 million put in the budget by Ronald Reagan, who in his State of the Union address in January of 1984 said that we need to work on this national treasure, the Chesapeake Bay, and mentioned it and put the funding that began the Bay program, which is now up to $70 million a year to fund all the staff and give grants to the local governments and states to do a non-point source control like stormwater. And so that agreement set the stage for a big 87 agreement, which everyone agreed to reduce phosphorus and nitrogen by 40% each. And then when they were abjectly failing, a lawsuit triggered the next big agreement, which was the Chesapeake 2000 agreement. So it's been 14 years. And these are the governors of the states of Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, the mayor of D.C., the head of the EPA, and the chair of the Chesapeake Bay Commission that signed this agreement solemnly. Well, when that voluntary program didn't work, the mandatory pollution limits were installed, called a TMDL, total maximum daily limit on phosphorus, nitrogen, and sediment. And that required to count the states to do watershed implementation plans, how they're going to meet those pollution loads. So that's mandatory now. The Bay program did achieve some successes, particularly for sewage treatment, but mostly for non-point like agriculture and stormwater, it was a failure. And so now the states are supposed to be meeting these, and how can the state of Maryland ever meet their stormwater goals without a strong funding mechanism and without implementation by the state? So the new Bay agreement is expanded to include West Virginia, New York, and Delaware. And quite frankly, New York could care less about the Chesapeake Bay. They've got other issues that far up the watershed. And West Virginia and Delaware aren't exactly environmentally crazy about, you know, doing things for right. Chesapeake Bay.
Or for themselves, for that matter. But
West Virginia is West Virginia.
Right.
Coal rules. So this new draft agreement is like the least common denominator that they could get all these new states for the first time to agree. And it leaves out, believe it or not, the most major pollution sources. There's not even a mention of agriculture pollution or stormwater. The development and growth population and development and growth sector that always was mentioned from the 87 and 2000 agreement in detail, even saying that population growth and development could overwhelm and overcome all of our hard-fought gains in reducing the pollutants to the bay. It's not even in the agreement. They agree to look at it and study those issues. And so agriculture isn't even mentioned. They leave out toxic chemicals. They even have a clause that says if any jurisdiction finds that any section here is not relevant or they have other methods to address these things, they don't have to do it. So we're saying, a group of 27 leaders joined by many citizens, including former Governor Glenn Denning, former U.S. Senator Tidings, former Congressman Wayne Gilchrist. I mean, you got Democrats, Republicans, county council members, former delegates, senators, and the head of the Virginia Department of Natural Resources, the former head, who was a delegate and served with me on a commission, Taylor Murphy, and the Sierra Club, Environment Maryland, Riverkeepers, PhDs, all have joined to tell the EPA and all of the Bay states, you need to either can this agreement, just back down, or put something in it that really does something and not pass a nothing burger.
So this comes on the heels of this comes on the heels of an agreement when it was originally signed in 1983, right?
Correct.
That had teeth in it that said, this is what we're going to have to meet.
Well, the 83 agreement didn't. The 83 agreement just said we got to work on the pollution and set up the mechanisms, the Chesapeake Executive Council, the Chesapeake Bay Program. But then they worked on specific goals. And the 87 agreement, just 4 years later, had the teeth in it. But remember, these are agreements that cannot be enforced mandatorily. They're what the states commit to. They all sign. They do press releases. And they're supposed to achieve this with all their worker bees, all the governor's
right,
top people
right.
working on this. So the agreement does set the tone. The biggest fear I have is with this new agreement, should it go and be signed, is that we think, when you talk to scholars on the Bay program, that this will then supersede the last agreement of 2000, which had over 100 very specific items that you needed to do. For instance, one of the things that's been in the agreement is that we want to restore bay grasses to maybe where they were in the 60s. That's 185,000 acres of these bay grasses. They're essential for crab shedding. They're essential for fisheries, for absorbing sediment, taking up toxic chemicals. And in 2012, we lost 15,000 acres, the wrong direction, and it was at the lowest level since 1986, way below the target of 2010, where we were supposed to get right. to 185. So you know what they do in the new agreement? They put the 185 off indefinitely and lower the target for all the acreage in this new agreement. It's like, are you kidding me? I wouldn't put my name on this if I was being tortured.
So what do our state officials say about this?
Well,
governor, MDE, any of
the,
what are
the
they
governor
saying?
Is now chairman of the Chesapeake Executive Council and has a major role. He has responded that he publicly that he would like to see some of the changes that the environmental community is squawking about. But I think that the governor would be in a hard spot if he didn't allow an agreement because he couldn't get the politics right with the other states. I mean, especially running for president, I don't think the governor is going to stand up and say, this is not the way to go. We need to really toughen this thing up, because it'll look bad for him as the head of the council. He's going to need cover of some agreement, and then they'll just do a press release. And with the way the journalism is now and the media with so few people, you know, you don't see the investigative thing saying this thing is really a piece of junk. You know, it really is. We're really upset, people from all over the state, that you really read it. You see how weak it is. We've proposed 28 really good measures to tighten this thing up.
Jerry, I mean, I know you have been, from the moment you went into public office, you've been a fighter for the environment, the bay, and where we live, and talking about no more trees down, and we got to stop developing, and you've been fighting these fights and putting it up there for people to hear. And I think there are many people in this world, in Maryland especially, who really do hear that and really want to do something about the environment. People do care. So the question is, where do you see us going from here? I mean, you've been in this a long time. It's your passion. You know about it intellectually.
Well, right now, politically, all of the insiders that work on the Bay and have the fever and the soul, and if many of whom have been at this for 30 and 40 years like I have, they're uniformly depressed about this political situation. It is clear that the politics have turned very, very uncivil and very, very negative in terms of environmental progress in the Bay, not just at the local level, but at the state level and at the national level. It's as if the environment is a passing thought. And in national and local polls, which some politicians are driven by instead of exerting leadership, the environment doesn't really register very high at all. It's one of the lower registering things anymore. So despite air pollution and water pollution and toxic waste and people dying from bad air, et cetera, you don't really see this environmental fervor that we had when we first began the Bay program and we continued in the 90s. Legislators can vote with impunity against the environment repeatedly, and still there are no real consequences. So unless there is a strong political movement to overcome these barriers, much along the lines of the civil rights movement, much along the lines of movements that have had great success, whether it's for rights for and the ending of discrimination against gay people, whether it's the Berlin Wall coming down where you really work on this and you're in common cause. I don't see this changing. I think it's going to get worse, because we're projected to grow by another million people here in Maryland by 2035, and that million people are not all moving in the city of Baltimore. You know, Baltimore lost population again in 2013. And what you're seeing is a very negativity that has come about, and you hate to be like that, because what all of us joining in common cause in our twilight years, whether it's former Governor Glendening or whether it's Senator Tidings or Bernie Fowler, you know, these people are in their 80s, or myself, I'm going to be 70. What we're seeing is the sands of time sifting through our fingers, and the Bay water quality declining and the fisheries collapsing. And we're really frightened that in our lifetime we're not going to be able to turn the corner. Now, having said that, the positive is that mainly because of wastewater treatment and things like the flush tax and the phosphorus ban on detergents, which I sponsored and took several years to get through the legislature, we have made some substantial progress. So today we flow millions of pounds less of nitrogen and phosphorus and sediments into the Bay than we did when we started in 1983. And despite 4 million more people in the watershed and the sprawl development, that is a very significant amount of progress. So we're not breaking our arms, patting ourselves on the back, because if we hadn't have done these things, it would be much worse than it is. But when I see my car mechanic unable to make a living,
right,
and almost in dying from just fishing in the South River and getting an infection that goes to his leg, where he's taken twice by ambulance to the shock trauma unit because they can't treat him in Anne Arundel or in his Queen Anne's County in the Easton Hospital. And I see this man's life right before him, when he says, I'll never go fishing again, I see other people similarly like that. A friend of mine got a different infection in his leg that almost killed him. I'm saying, how far do things have to decline into a nightmare scenario that we were really in right now? So unless the politics change, there is no real strong hope, because people have to make sure that this is an issue, and we need a very strong Maryland League of Conservation voters to get the money, like CBF, Chesapeake Bay Foundation, gets $24 million, but they don't engage in political races at all. They do not endorse candidates. And so some of that $24 million needs to go to build a very strong Maryland League of Conservation Voters. I served on the board for almost 10 years when I got out of office. And they can make a difference if they had more zeros after their yearly income, so that they can make sure we're electing environmentally concerned elected officials, and that people can't vote with impunity like they're doing against the Bay. When I was in, people would have not taken these stances like this. They would have risked their election, or they cared about the Bay more.
General Weingrat, when you were there on Senate, you were known as the environmental conscience of the state Senate, former state senator, retired commander, is it?
Right, in the Navy.
U.S. Navy, always good to have you here. Thank you so much for the fight you continue. It's always great to have your voice in the air with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm about to talk with Will Allen. He's a former professional basketball player. He's an urban farmer in Milwaukee, CEO of Growing Power, a nonprofit and land trust that works to help provide people equal access to healthy, high-quality, safe, and affordable food for folks in all communities. He wrote the book, The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities. I remember when we last spoke, you were working on a piece to provide food for the schools in Milwaukee. How is that project coming?
Well, we've moved along a continuum now to not only Milwaukee, but in a regional sense, to get our food into the Chicago public school system that has 409,000 students. We just did the largest farm-to-school procurement in the history of USDA, where we delivered 30,000 pounds of carrots that we grew last summer, this winter, for a one-day lunch consumption. So that was something that took us about 4 years to put all the pieces together to make that work.
So, I mean, that has become an issue for people all over the country. I've interviewed a number of people who are trying to change the nature of the diet in our cities, in our public school systems across America. And I keep thinking about how the billions and billions of dollars, I know here in Maryland where we're talking right now, the collective amount from all of our public school systems on food is about $1 billion or more.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it's think about how
a lot of dollars involved. And but one of the big challenges we have is putting this whole thing together, because you need about four or five different entities working together to make it happen. You have to coordinate working with the school board and, of course, the producer, but also the processor, and somebody who's delivering that finished product to the individual schools. Is a big piece, but with all the one of the other big challenges is today, many of our children are being fed by a system of food providers. The food isn't generated necessarily at the schools anymore. It's done by companies like Armark and Sodexo and Chartwell and Bon Appetit. So you have to have them in the mix as well to make this work. So it's not something you can put together. And of course, the most important piece of this whole thing is the production piece, to be able to coordinate the farmers that are willing to participate in what I call a social justice kind of a project. So they have to give a little, everybody has to give a little bit. And it's difficult for farmers who are at the lowest end of the food dollar chain. So that's the difficult part, is to find the producers that can that want to participate in the project.
So I wonder, you've said before that you know, we've lost a million farmers since 1960, and you talk about America now has like 23 million food deserts, I think, as you put it, defined as urban neighborhoods and rural towns without access to fresh, healthier, affordable food. So I'm curious how you see and what you see as the future of how farms within urban areas can fill that gap. How much do you think that in the long run that can provide?
Well, it's the only way, I believe, and this is my opinion, and it's the opinion of a lot of folks, that the only way to end the food crisis we have, not only in this country, but around the world, is to do it on a local and regional level, because that's the way our food system used to be back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but we've gotten away from that. And when we look at the future, if we're able to look at a crystal ball or vision into the future, where so much of our food is coming out of California, and that's an unsustainable farm system because of the fact that water is a big issue out there.
Yeah.
Water rationing is happening. Seawater is coming into the wells from the Pacific. So that's a really unsustainable way for us to continue to operate. And the huge cost of fuel and shipping food from all over the world into our large metropolitan areas like Chicago and New York, and even in our small towns where much of the food is being shipped into these small towns that used to be agricultural towns, but the agriculture infrastructure has gone away, and we really have to build food systems in these small towns as well as the large cities. So it's not just a urban issue. There are food deserts in small communities all over America.
So ultimately, how do you think that's going to be fixed? I mean, there's some people discussed the question of kind of food hubs as being one of the ways that this can be done, of having small, organic, and sustainable, not always the same thing, farmers working to get their food out in a more organized way, with food hubs getting food out from small farmers so they can survive, and people can actually have really good, healthy, local farm food less expensive and acquire less expensively. I mean, how do you see that happening?
Well, I don't want to put the cart before the horse, because we can build all of these food hubs, but the number one thing we need to do is grow farmers. We don't have enough farmers to grow the healthy food, because only about 3% really of our food is high nutrient-rich food. So what we have to do is grow farmers and train farmers, and you can't do that overnight. You can't grow a farmer overnight. So these farmer training programs that are primarily being done by nonprofits, and I think that's the role of nonprofits, is to be able to do that kind of training. But it's not the role of nonprofits, even one as big as ours, where we have 300 acres of outside production, 25 acres of greenhouse production. And the only reason that we have that infrastructure is back 20 years ago, I kind of wanted to prove that this could be done. And we built this infrastructure that now we have to control. But it's going to be done by entrepreneurs on the for-profit side. And that's going to take a while because, like I said, we can't grow a farmer and teach them all the skills to be able to grow intensively on less acreage, working with a lot of folks in the communities. Again, whether it's in a rural community or in an urban community, you have to build those relationships that take time. So everybody wants this to happen overnight. But again, as Growing Power is in its 21st year, and things really started to happen for us about 5 or 6 years ago, where we really started to increase our ability to be able to get food to all sectors of our community through all different types of, our marketing scheme gets food to everybody in our community, and that's the same food. It's not like we have different types of food. It may be culturally appropriate, but it's good food grown in good soil without chemicals. So that's what we have to do, and we have to be able to work with companies like, whether we like it or not, we're going to have to work with companies like Sysco and Walmart and Midwest Foods, in our case, in the Midwest, in Chicago, that buy $2 million worth of locally and regionally grown food and get it out to the community. So we're going to have everybody at the table. No longer can we just have crusty old farmers like myself and people studying the food system from universities, but we need to have politicos at the table and medical folks and corporate companies. We have the community. We have to have everybody at the table to make this work and really develop relationships that develop these partnerships to really change the food system in our communities.
One of the things you also said, I think, in terms of the jobs you've you said that that you helped create in Milwaukee around farming and agriculture. You made this comment, I think, once that growing food is a way to fight crime because it creates jobs. That's it. That's given a poor inner city neighborhoods, be they black, white, Native American, Mexican, Puerto Rican, or white, whatever they are. That's a very important thing to think about.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many studies that prove that if a community is food secure, the crime rate is very low. Because, and this is a great opportunity for us if we get serious about it, and it's going to take more than just an organization like Growing Power or a bunch of Growing Powers around the country to make this happen, because everybody's going to have to participate in this in terms of how do we rebuild our communities. We have all this vacant land in the communities, but once you take a street that had 30 houses and now you have 10 houses, you want to have a mixture of new houses going up and not just turn all of that vacant land into gardens. That's not the answer. We have to rebuild these communities, and in rebuilding these communities, there's job creation. There's job creation in terms of the agricultural infrastructure that we've proven that. That you can put people to work at living wage jobs, but you have to have principles around what you're going to pay these people work in the industry. And we start out in our workforce training program at $12 an hour, which is way above the minimum wage.
Yep.
And if they make it through a year, we guarantee them a job. So no other workforce programs around the country really do that. So I think we have to stick to some strong principles about how we treat people, how we try to retain people long enough, anchor them long enough in a good-paying job so that we can get them trained. So that's something that I'm very committed to. It's something I talk about all the time to groups around the country, that this is how we have to do it.
It sounds in some ways like over these years of helping build and grow growing power and creating this new world of farming, I mean, you have learned a lot yourself, and this has altered you in many ways.
Oh, yeah. You know, being a farmer, you never stop learning. It's one thing that will keep you grounded and keep you modest, and is the fact that it's the most challenging profession, becoming a sustainable farmer, be able to grow food without chemicals and deliver that food to all people in the community is a very difficult thing to do. So what helps me is I kind of glean a lot of things from all the experiences I have in life in terms of working in corporate America. I try to take the best things I've learned, growing up on a farm, playing team sports. All of those things I kind of bring into how I operate Growing Power. And a lot of people now are starting to replicate what we've done in their own cultural way, because I always tell people, regardless of where you're from, everything that we do has been done before, except we put our own little twist to it, maybe add renewable energy or different things to our operation. But when you think about aquaculture and aquaponics, it's been done in ancient times. So I tell groups to learn in a conceptual way, take it back to your community, and make it work for your community, because every community is different. But learn in a conceptual way, but don't try to necessarily replicate verbatim what Growing Power does.
Well, Alan, thank you for all you do, and thank you for taking the time today, and take care, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.